It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangechamps. Every day, we see dozens of other living beings. Humans, yes, but also dogs, birds, trees, insects, all our fellow creatures on this planet. Now, what if we considered all of them persons?
Human people are only one kind of person. There are maple people, right? And there are oriole people, and there are cloud people. And that changes everything.
This is Robin Wall Kimmerer, plant scientist, award-winning writer, and enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. And this is her land. 7 acres in the southern hills of Onondaga County, New York, near the Finger Lakes.
We could walk up here if you've got a minute.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So I grow a big vegetable garden that I can eat out of most of the year. And then the rest of my 7-acre piece, I honestly think of as a garden as well. It's an old field and a little patch of woods and a pond and springs. Almost a self-sufficient landscape. They're little green herons. They've nested here for years, and their babies make these just awful, squawky noises. So that's who we're hearing.
I love that.
Yeah. Robin calls this a generous landscape.
A lot of edibles, lots of berries, cordage plants. I really like to do basketry. So I have willows and red buds, and I grow things like nettles and dogbane.
Look how beautiful.
Isn't it beautiful? That is sweetgrass. Wingushk are one of our sacred plants. Just take it and rub it between your fingers. Pretty soon the fragrance of it will start to be released.
That lovely grassy smell.
Yeah. Most of the medicines that I like to use, I want to have growing here. Healol and raspberries, which is women's medicine. Agrimony, which is a wound healer. Yarrow, which is a fever reducer. So that's why I think of the whole landscape as a garden.
A garden and a pharmacy.
A garden, a pharmacy, a library, yeah. There's something inherent about these lands that make you feel taken care of. What else could you say? All of the food, medicine, teachings. It feels like a landscape that loves you back.
We share the landscapes we call home with countless other beings. Trees, plants, birds, frogs. In many cultures, they're considered relatives, our more than human kin. And now emerging science in everything from forest ecology to the microbiome is confirming that. So what changes when you see the natural world as kin? Well, that's exactly what Robin Wall Kimmerer has been writing about for years. It was a hot July day, the summer before the pandemic, when Steve and I first saw her place. We sat together in her front yard, under an enormous maple tree. Our dog and her cat circled our feet, and we talked about the personhood of nature and why that concept matters.
As people, as persons, when the crops are a person, when the trees are a person, when that deer is a person, you can't just take, right? You have to show respect to that person. You have to ask permission. You have to negotiate a trade. There has to be reciprocity.
Personhood also suggests agency, intelligence, maybe. It suggests, I don't know, consciousness, does it?
When I say that aspen tree is a person, I mean it in all those elements that you just mentioned, that yes, this is a sentient being, a conscious being, a being with its own intelligence. You know, Western science tells us, oh, you must not anthropomorphize. I'm not anthropomorphizing. I'm botanizing. That aspen is its own kind of person. It's not like they're human people. They're aspen people.
The maple, that beautiful maple over there. Is there a way to explain its personhood using Western scientific language or not?
So could I prove to you with scientific instruments the sentience of this maple? No. But the science is moving absolutely in the direction to have us understand the intelligence of plants. There are, of course, emerging tools that tell you all about the electrochemical gradients in this maple and what they respond to and the way the sophistication with which this tree senses, behaves, makes decisions that are so sophisticated and beyond our knowing.
I love your concept that our society has become plant blind, that our grandparents could identify many more species of plants just sitting here in the backyard than their grandchildren. We can.
Absolutely.
Well, not you.
It was a matter of survival. We are hardwired to know plants. We have this taxonomic part of our brain which is so good at discerning one thing from the next. And of course we had to. When you think about the hundreds of thousands of plants that there are, you had better not be plant blind. You had better know which one of those is medicine and which one will really give you a stomach ache. So absolutely, so much of us, who we are, is a legacy of needing to know plants. And it's just this eye blink of time in the industrial age that we have become plant blind.
So when you say plants are our relatives, you're actually saying genetically?
I'd have to look up and remember what the fraction of our DNA that we share, me and that maple tree right there, it's over 80%. The chlorophyll molecule that powers everything in the trees is so similar to your hemoglobin. For me, one of the most powerful kinds of relatedness is that as I'm talking to you, the carbon dioxide that is coming out of my mouth is seconds later being made into sugar by our maple companion.
Seconds?
Seconds. The air that we are breathing right now is their exhalation.
Which means that we and the tree are one being, in a way.
We are indeed.
For you, you've been studying the Potawatomi language, Anishinaabe Mohan, and some of this, you said, is embedded in the language.
It is. If we think, for example, of that grapevine climbing on the pole over there, I would say to you, hey, Steve, look at it. Right? If Anne was over, they'd say, look at her. We have a different language for each other, but all of nature gets termed it. And in English, we have no escape from that. It is the manifestation of that worldview which objectifies nature. And in Anishinaabe Mohan, it is not possible to speak of that robin or that strawberry as an it. It is not possible because we speak with a grammar of animacy.
Is there an animate case and an inanimate case?
Exactly, exactly. And it's a verb-based language. So one of my favorite examples is that you hear the wind with an animate verb, but if an airplane went over, we would hear it with an inanimate verb.
Oh, so there are cases for the verbs too, animate and inanimate verbs.
Well, most of our language is verbs. It's about 70% of the Anishinaabe Mohan is verbs, and 70% of English is nouns.
Can I follow up on some of the language that we use to express notions of kinship? I know you've sort of been exploring that notion of even what the word kin means, and can you talk about that?
I was doing kind of a thought experiment about how we might animate English. And with the guidance of my language teacher and elder, I was looking for another pronoun that we could use. And he gave to me, he said, well, the word in our language for just a being is bemadisi, aki. And Aki means the earth, and that little sound, ki, I've been suggesting we could use as a replacement for it. So when we look at that grapevine, we say ki is climbing the fence. And it slides right next to he and she. Mm-hmm. He, she, and ki. And I played with that idea for a long time, and then realizing that you'd need plurals, and that we already had that beautiful word in English of kin. And it's so happy-making, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, you think about a flock of birds migrating, and there go our kin.
Exactly. I'm going to go up in the fields and be with my kin and see if they'll give me some berries. It just changes your whole orientation. I mean, think about how we do this. We walk through the world saying, that's a pine. Well, would I say of my neighbor, that's a human?
How did we forget all of this? The language and the worldview that you're describing were here for millennia, probably, before European settlers showed up.
This change of worldview was not a passive forgetting, was it? This change of worldview from the industrial, colonial, frontier mindset to overlay the indigenous way of knowing was no accident. It was very, very deliberate. And of course it was. If you came into a world where you saw that those pines were people, teachers, ones who were giving you medicine, who were caring for you, would you come in and claim every damn one of them for the King of England? Would you put his mark on them? Would you devastate the landscape? It was a genocide of pines in our way of thinking. And it's tied to this notion of human exceptionalism that we're at the top of this pyramid of intelligence, of spirituality, of resources, of any way you cut it. Human beings, according to Western religions and Western economies, are at the top. Everything else belongs to us.
And speaking of plants, plants are often at the bottom. What would indigenous teachings, where would indigenous teaching place plants?
Plants are understood as among the most revered of beings. In my Haudenosaunee neighbors have the beautiful language for this. They say that human people are the younger brothers of creation. We are some of the last ones to come here. We're still trying to figure out how to live here, obviously.
Like toddlers, we're kind of making a mess.
Yeah, we are. We are. But there is this other way of putting your hands in the earth and getting to work and saying, yeah, we've made a lot of mistakes, but we can be healers too, and we have to be healers too. So this is the veggie garden. I've been growing a lot of heritage beans.
How many kinds?
Let's see, there's cranberry beans, there's bear beans, there's a bean that we call the Potawatomi rabbit poop bean.
Why? How did it get that name?
They look like little rabbit turds.
Robin Wall Kimmerer tends 7 acres of land on the historic territory of the Onondaga people. You can see photos on our website at ttbook.org. If you haven't read it yet, I highly recommend Robin's book, Braiding Sweetgrass. The 6-year anniversary edition is just out and climbing the bestseller list.
Well, this is a pretty big garden to cultivate.
It is. It's a joy.